Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
People just can't believe that in America today that this type of thing is happening, and the police that were involved. You would think that the police would be here to protect people from doing this to my sister, right? But no, they were protecting Michael in order that nobody would stop Terry from being killed. It was absolutely surreal. It was a nightmare.
That's Bobby Schindler. We talked with him last year. He was reflecting some 4 years after the event on the death of his sister, Terry Schindler Schiavo. She, of course, was dehydrated to death, starved to death as well, by her estranged husband, Michael Schiavo. And it was all in the news. And, of course, many paid close attention. It was a heart-wrenching story. Says something about bioethics in the United States today, especially as we step into the 21st century. Joining us to talk about the top bioethics stories of the past decade, Wesley Smith. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of a recent column for National Review titled Technological Morality, the Top 10 Bioethics Stories of the Decade. Wesley, welcome back.
Happy New Year, Todd.
And to you as well. It was 5 years ago. It was a heart-wrenching story, and many do note she is a household name, Terry Schindler Schiavo. But many would say it's not an isolated incident. Why did you make it your top bioethics story for the last decade?
I don't think there was any single story in the world that got as much attention involving bioethics as Terry Schiavo, nor one as important. Because you're right, it is done quite a bit. But before Terry Schiavo, people didn't know that. When I used to give speeches about how people with profound cognitive disabilities are literally dehydrated to death slowly over 14 days in every state in this country, people would look at me and say, I had no idea. Nobody can say that anymore. And in fact, it seems to me that Terry's case forced us to decide which side of that issue we were on. So now we've all made our own decisions, and we all have, I think, moral accountability for this kind of behavior. In Italy, there was a similar case called Elena El Guaro. This is a woman whose father wanted her feeding tube pulled, and there was a huge fight there with doctors refusing to do it. That brought up the whole Terry Schiavo thing again. In Belgium, there's a man named Rom Holbens, who was diagnosed for 23 years to be in a persistent vegetative state, and then new sophisticated testing, the kind that Judge Greer refused to give to Terry Schiavo, discovered that he wasn't unconscious at all, that he had near-normal brain waves, and in fact, he is now interactive after receiving some therapy. And on the day that Terry died, people thought he was in the same position, and he could have suffered the same fate. So, and the first thing that the media thought of when they heard about the Rom Holbens case was, how is this different from Terry Schiavo? Every time we have one of these miraculous awakenings or a dispute over this kind of situation, the media's first response is, this is different than Terry Schiavo. And so I think she continues to haunt us, if you will. And I think that this case continues to disturb us, and I'm glad that it does, because it's a very important thing and a very serious matter that both symbolically and physically, when you take away somebody's sustenance, you're making a statement about their usefulness as a human being that I think is very disturbing.
I interviewed Bobby Schindler for an hour, and one thing I remember him saying over and over again as he reflected on his sister's death was the most frustrating thing for him and his family was that people were being told in the media, people were believing without questioning, that Terry was dying.
Yeah, she wasn't dying, except they were taking away her food and water. I mean, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, wasn't it? She did not need a respirator. She was able to swallow her own saliva. She was obviously not able to chew and swallow food. She probably would have had a normal lifespan. And this dehydration was because her husband, who was going to receive a lot of money if she died when he started this thing, not when he ended it because of all the legal fees. I mean, she paid the lawyers to make her dead, which is another irony. But he and his family said that she'd made some kind of vague statements about not wanting to live. So based on some a 25 or 26-year-old young woman making some vague statements, a judge decided by clear and convincing evidence that she would want to be dehydrated to death and not allow her blood family to care for her, even though her husband was at that time living with another woman and had two children by her and called her his fiancé. So, I mean, the injustices of this case were so profound that in the United States Senate, every single senator, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, gave unanimous consent to the federal law to try to save Terri Schiavo's life. It's now been recast as somehow the conservative Republicans coming in. Barack Obama gave consent, the president today, senator then. Hillary Clinton gave consent. John McCain gave consent. John Kerry gave consent. And in the House, about 40% of the Democratic caucus gave consent. It was one of the most bipartisan bills during the Bush presidency. And then they say, well, Bush came flying back to sign the bill. Right, because she was dehydrating to death. If he had not flown back to sign the bill, it would have been no point in having the bill passed. So the myths about this case continue to be perpetuated. Misstatements about the autopsy did not prove beyond 100% doubt that she was unconscious and, in fact, was consistent with that or with what's called a minimally conscious state, and it shouldn't matter. This is a human being. If you did to a dog what you did to Terri Schiavo, you would go to jail. If you did to Osama bin Laden what you did to Terri Schiavo, you would be put up on for war crimes in The Hague. Yet because she was a cognitively disabled patient, it was called medical ethics.
The full promise of stem cell research remains unknown, and it should not be overstated. But scientists believe these tiny cells may have the potential to help us understand and possibly cure some of our most devastating diseases and conditions, to regenerate a severed spinal cord and lift someone from a wheelchair, to spur insulin production and spare a child from a lifetime of needles, to treat Parkinson's, cancer, heart disease.
That's President Barack Obama, of course, enumerating what are the alleged promises of embryonic stem cell research. You list as second on your list of bioethics stories for the last decade, the Bush embryonic stem cell funding policy. What was it, and what did we lose when it was overturned recently?
You know, it was a huge story around the world, and in fact, overcoming the Bush funding restrictions became the template for media coverage of this entire issue. The policy itself was not that big a policy. It wasn't that he didn't provide funding for embryonic stem cell research. He did. I would say off the top of my head that during the Bush years, about $160 to $175 million was put into human embryonic stem cell research. During the Bush years, according to the Rockefeller Institute, more than $2 billion was put into human embryonic stem cell research in the United States through public, private, and philanthropic means. So, I mean, it wasn't like it was withering on the vine. There were some inconveniences, of course, because if you wanted to receive federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, you'd have to segregate, if you were a scientist, the work you were doing on those stem cell lines with perhaps a stem cell line that wasn't what was called Bush qualified, and that meant the cell lines had to be in existence before August 9th, 2001 to qualify for federal funding. It was really what really set off, I think, the explosion was that Bush's policy had a very strong implied message, and that was that as nascent human life, embryos matter morally. And that it is wrong to treat embryos, even early embryos at the one-week stage, because they are human, as if they were a corn crop ripe for the harvest. That was the message that Bush signaled with his embryonic stem cell funding policy. That is what got caught up in the politics, And that is what made it a huge, huge story. Interestingly, when the induced pluripotent stem cells came to pass, and that is turning like normal skin cells into pluripotent stem cells, similar to embryonic stem cells, the whole issue kind of lost its pizzazz, and it became an anticlimax when President Obama rescinded the Bush policy. So it was the second most important story of the decade because almost the entire media and discussion surrounded the Bush policy to the point that adult stem cell research, which was achieving some of the, in early human trials, some of the very benefits that President Obama said might eventually be available from embryonic stem cell, that hardly got covered at all. It was the most underreported, perhaps underreported story of the decade, because that success of the adult stem cells got in the way of the storyline that the media wanted to tell, which was that George Bush was impeding cures.
Well, closely related, and we'll get to this on the other side of the break, Wesley's third top story from the last decade in bioethics, what he calls in vitro fertilization anarchy, turning childbirth into mass production, as in the case of Nadia Suleiman, so-called Octomom. Also, I want to return to what he just mentioned, the success of adult stem cell research, not much heard in the press, but of course he puts it at fifth. We'll also talk about suicide tourism in Switzerland, the legalization of assisted suicide in Washington, and the increased number of pro-life attitudes among Americans, down on the list but still making his top 10 bioethics stories for the last decade. Wesley Smith is our guest. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of a recent column for National Review titled Technological Morality, the Top 10 Bioethics Stories of the Decade. You can check it out at our website, issuesetc.org. Our email address this afternoon, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our phone number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal is out. It contains an article I've written titled Legalism and License. How are these two really the same error? Find out with the latest Issues Etc. journal. You can also read about Pastor Brian Wolfmiller's journey from liberal Lutheranism and navel-gazing evangelicalism to the external promises of God in Holy Scripture. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over Casserole Inn. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the three Concordia bookstores downtown, in Kirkwood, and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address, LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration. We're talking about the top bioethics stories of the past decade. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Wesley, closely related to what you were talking about before the break, you also list what you call IVF anarchy, in vitro fertilization anarchy. What do you mean?
Well, the whole in vitro fertilization field is almost completely unregulated, and that has led to tremendous changes in our culture. If you take a look at the embryonic stem cell research that we were just discussing, because there was no limit on the number of embryos that physicians could make during the procedure, we ended up with 400,000 leftovers, quote-unquote, in the deep freeze, which are now looked upon as mere natural resources by a lot of scientists. You had the Octomom, which you described earlier, where this is a woman who is not infertile, but just decided she wanted to have a lot of children, and she now has had 14 children via IVF. You have people using a pre-diagnosis, pre-implantation diagnosis, genetic diagnosis, now to begin to engage in eugenic selection of embryos, including, beyond the issues of health, things such as blonde hair or blue eyes. You have people using IVF now. The idea is to have three parents. So it's helped turn the whole concept of procreation into manufacture, and that the child becomes a product, something, not in every case, obviously, but in some cases, the child can become and be seen as a product, to be a consumer product to satisfy the needs of the parents, rather than a new beloved life loved unconditionally by parents.
All right, then let's talk about what you say. Switzerland has become Jack Kevorkian as a country. What in the world goes on there with what you call suicide tourism?
Assisted suicide is legal in Switzerland so long as you do not have a venal motive. And that has led to the opening of suicide clinics that take people from all over the world, and that's the term called suicide tourism, people who fly there to commit suicide in these clinics. And that has especially been disturbing in the UK, where many of these suicide tourist cases have come from, with a lot of very emotional narratives. For example, parents took their quadriplegic son who was injured in a rugby scrimmage to receive suicide in Switzerland. I can't imagine parents taking a child to get suicide, but they did, and that then became a big hue and cry in England and so forth for legalization of assisted suicide over there, to the point that the head prosecutor of England and Wales basically wrote a policy saying that if family members assist the suicides of terminally ill people, seriously disabled people, or people with degenerating neurological conditions, and they have good motives again, there will not be a prosecution. That, in essence, decriminalized assisted suicide by family members of these most defenseless patients. And that's why suicide tourism, kind of like Jack Kevorkian, audacity was rewarded. And that's why I thought it was a very important story.
Where would you put the legalization of assisted suicide in the state of Washington here in the United States?
I put that up at number six because I don't think that had the impact around the world that suicide tourism did. It also doesn't show the actual agenda that suicide tourism does. Realize that in suicide tourism, because of lawsuits filed in Switzerland, the mentally ill have the right to receive assisted suicide, a constitutional right to receive assisted suicide in Switzerland. And that, to me, makes it a very much bigger thing. The equivalent here is the Final Exit Network, which you might call mobile suicide clinics, where people go to people's homes with helium and other paraphernalia to help people kill themselves. In fact, there was just a big case in Phoenix where somebody with a mental illness was assisted in suicide, and there was a guilty verdict from a member of the Final Exit Network there, a guilty plea, and that person is going to testify against his his co-conspirators. I think it was a he. But because I thought that whole issue and the Kevorkian kind of approach in Switzerland was more important than the state of Washington legalizing it through the initiative, although that was important at number six, Also important and interestingly was that as soon as it was legalized, there was a very big pushback. Many members of the legal, of the medical community saying we will not participate. Many hospitals like the Providence Hospital Network saying they would not participate. And so the pushback in Washington, even though it became legal, was also very notable.
Why did healthcare reform make your list?
Because it was the story of 2009, which became an important issue of the decade, because in the next decade coming, we're really going to be fighting over how to provide health care in this country, as are other countries. You know, what mix of public and private initiatives? Do we have health care rationing, which is a big problem with potential problem with Obamacare? It wasn't the story of, I think I put it at number nine, because it was only 1 year of the decade. But I think in the next decade, it's going to be a very big story. And the costs of this in an aging society are also going to be a very big story. So I thought it was certainly worth putting in the list. It's interesting, I've been overseas, and the people overseas seem almost as caught up in the debate about Obamacare as we are.
Talk a bit about the shift in the first decade of the new millennium in Americans' attitude about abortion and about the general pro-life positions.
Well, the Gallup poll showed a real reversal, and I put this in at number eight. When the decade began, about 48% of respondents were pro-choice, and that's what the term was used by, and I really appreciate that by Gallup, because it's, I think people should be able to be called how they identify themselves. So the Gallup poll in 2000 found that 48% were pro-choice and 43% were pro-life. 9 years later, that had more than reversed, with 51% pro-life and only 42% pro-choice. That's quite a turnaround. That led, I think, to a couple of important policy changes. For example, the ban on partial birth abortion, the Infant Born Alive Protection Act. And if that trend continues, and one doesn't know whether it will, of course, but it is quite possible that the Roe regime itself could be threatened, because if it turns out that, let's say, at some point that 35% of the people are pro-choice, I think the Supreme Court tends to follow the election returns. You might see a different result than you would have perhaps today, or certainly 10 years ago.
With only a minute here, Wesley, what do you think will be the bioethics story, the top bioethics story of the coming decade?
You know, I'm still thinking about that. But I think the desire to turn human beings into natural resources will expand. The idea of taking organs from people like Terry Schiavo, there's a lot of agitation that's not happening to redefine death, to include a diagnosis of persistent vegetative state, suicide tourism, people going to China and other poor countries to either rent, to obtain organs from people, buy kidneys, rent wombs. This kind of thing. If cloning becomes possible, I think you're going to see a mass effort, because you need a lot of human eggs for that, to have poor women in destitute countries sell their eggs, which could lead to very serious health consequences for them. I think the idea of the human body and human beings as a natural resource will be, if not the top bioethics story of the coming decade, certainly one of them.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of a recent column for National Review titled Technological Morality, the Top 10 Bioethics Stories of the Decade. Wesley, thank you very much.
Good talking to you again.
Folks, we've been defending life from beginning to end here on Issues Etc. for more than a decade, and you could stand with us by joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual giving program. Membership benefits include items like T-shirts, books, transcripts. Find out more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club this year. We face, oh my goodness, what we face in the next decade. Who could have said at the beginning of the aughts, as they're now called, what would we be facing in terms of bioethics? It's a brave new world and one that is fraught with danger. And if we continue to disregard the value of human life from beginning to end, there really is no limit to what we will do to one another, how we will exploit one another. And sad to say, how we will exploit those least capable of defending themselves. Which means, along with all the bioethical challenges facing us in the years to come, we need added and strengthened resolve to defend life from beginning to end. Not only as a matter of principle, but because we're really dealing with our neighbors here, aren't we? Whether it is the days-old embryo in the womb or the petri dish or in a vat of liquid nitrogen, or whether it is the person lying incapacitated or elderly in a hospital bed or a nursing home bed, our neighbor, one called as Christians to defend, to protect, and to love from beginning to end. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.